After a difficult election in 2016, the Labour Party is trying to win back seats in this campaign. However, the party is facing a battle to hold or retain its traditional core vote in an increasingly competitive left-wing political field. Polls put the Labour Party between 4 and 6%, a percentage it's aiming to increase by targeting key constituencies across the country. We'll be talking to the Labour leader, Brendan Howland, later in the programme. But first, our reporter, Fiacra O'Kioni, went on a canvass with the Labour Party leader in one of the constituencies targeted by Labour in this general election, Cork North Central, where Councillor John Maher is hoping to win back the seat lost by Kathleen Lynch in 2016.
Liz, we'll go down to Sveno and to Silver Heights Drive and we'll walk up along both sides.
Okay. A week into the general election campaign, the Cork North Central Dáil battle is heating up. And the constituency dogfight is not for the faint-hearted. Labour is trying to win back the seat it lost in 2016 with new councillor John Maher running, with the support of a number of high-profile colleagues.
Getting familiar with this constituency now, because this guy is worth it. So if you can give him your number one vote 2 weeks from Saturday, it'd be really good. He won't let you down. Apologies for disturbing you. Hi,
you're all right.
Brendan Howland, doing a canvass for John here.
Right.
For the general election.
You did.
You met him in the locals anyway.
I did.
And he's a
great
guy.
Three elections in 8 months. We're gluttons for punishment.
We're on the trail again.
I see that.
I know, and we know the story. But listen, if you can look after us,
we'll
appreciate it. Yeah, it won't be a wasted vote.
Look,
what we will do, right? I am here tonight to ask you to trust me with your number one. But
Before you finish, right, I will have to. My mother never won't want me to start giving my cards away. But the reason I won't be giving you a number one is because I am pro-life.
Okay.
Labour Party are not.
Absolutely.
In fact, your party leader there has been quite outspoken.
We can solve the housing crisis.
Housing is the main issue. And that will have me voting for Sinn Féin.
Right.
Because they're going to tackle it. I have two children.
Okay.
They're in their 30s. They'd be lucky to be able to run a car, not a mind buy a house.
Liz Dunphy, a Cork-based journalist with the Irish Examiner, says these issues show Labour's John Maher is in contention for a seat, but will face significant competition from other candidates.
This constituency, it's really all to play for. It's a very competitive constituency. There are 16 people currently contesting just 4 seats, but 3 of the incumbents are not contesting their seats in this coming election. So it's wide open. Traditionally, Cork North Central is quite a Fianna Fáil stronghold. It's the constituency of former Fianna Fáil Taoiseach Jack Lynch in the 80s. It had 3 of the then 5 seats in the constituency. So you would definitely expect to see at least one Fianna Fáil seat held here. Sinn Féin is a party that's also really built up a lot of profile in this constituency recently. And Jonathan O'Brien, the Sinn Féin TD for the area, has recently announced that he's not running. So that seat would be open, presumably, for Sinn Féin councillor Thomas Gould, who topped the polls recently in the local election. You would also expect to see potentially a second Fianna Fáil seat or a Fine Gael. Labour, who knows? It's really all to play for here. It's going to be an exciting election.
An exciting election for those watching from the sidelines. But for those taking part, that excitement means a nervous wait to see what the voters decide in just over 2 weeks' time.
It won't be a wasted vote.
It's hard to know who to trust at this stage. I'd be honest with you.
And I understand what you're saying. I understand what you're saying. And I laugh, right? My mam is out there with me, right? And if I go away lying or telling any tales, no better person to run up to Dublin and catch me back and say, what did you do? And that's what we're about. All we're ordinary working people who want to represent people. Right. So if you can trust us, I genuinely would appreciate it. It won't be a wasted vote.
All right.
Did anything John said there, did it win you over or did it convince you, or is it just what everybody else is saying?
Well, I'm not sure. I'd have to think about it. I mean, he said to trust them, but we trusted them before and they didn't, you know, any party. I'm not just talking about him, but any party. It's very hard to know who to trust at this stage.
Fiacra O'Kioni reporting. And the dog that you heard earlier on in that package, who didn't sound terribly happy, was called Waffle. We'll be talking to the Labour Party leader, Brendan Howlan, later in the programme. The full list of candidates running in Cork North Central: Colin Burke, Fine Gael, Lorraine O'Neill, Fine Gael, Pádraig O'Sullivan, Fianna Fáil, Sandra Murphy, Fianna Fáil, Tony Fitzgerald, Fianna Fáil, Thomas Gould, Sinn Féin, John Maher, Labour, Mick Barry, Solidarity, People Before Profit, Sinead Halpin, Social Democrats, Oliver Moore and Green Party, James Coughlin, Workers' Party, Fintan Toomey, Aintu, Dermot O'Kyla, Independent, Kenneth O'Flynn, Independent, TJ Hogan, Independent, Stephen O'Donovan, Independent, Ger Kyowen, Independent and Sean O'Leary, Independent.
Recruiter CPL Resources has reported higher profits and revenues for the first 6 months of the year to the end of December. It says profit before tax for the full year should be ahead of what the market expects. It's paying an interim dividend of 10 cents per share. That's up 25% on this time last year. Shares in China and Hong Kong have fallen after the authorities quarantined the Chinese city at the centre of the coronavirus outbreak. China's benchmark index was down 3%. Hong Kong was 2% lower. China's currency weakened against the dollar. Christine Lagarde is to launch a review of the European Central Bank's policy today. She and the committee are not expected to announce any big changes. They'll continue to buy bonds and say they'll cut interest rates further if they need to. The bank has fallen short of its inflation target of 2% for years now, despite aggressive measures introduced by her predecessor Mario Draghi. Currencies: the euro is trading at just below $1.11 and 84.4 pence sterling.
Will, this time yesterday you were telling us that you expected developments on the digital tax. There were developments, the French finance minister saying this morning that they're close to a deal with the US. What else has been happening?
Good morning, Rachel. Well, trade and tax were much talked about issues yesterday, but the climate crisis remains front and centre. Perhaps the most significant comments on the topic yesterday came from Prince Charles. He was back at Davos for the first time in 3 decades, and he said the intervening period during which he had dedicated much of his time to restoring harmony between humanity, nature and the environment, and to the encouragement of corporate social and environmental responsibility, had all been a bit of an uphill struggle. But he said that he had come to realise that it was not a lack of capital that is holding us back, but rather the way in which we deploy it. And so to move forward, we need nothing short of a paradigm shift, he said.
Do we want to go down in history as the people who did nothing to bring the world back from the brink in time to restore the balance when we could have done? I don't want to. And just think for a moment, what good is all the extra wealth in the world gained from business as usual if you can do nothing with it except watch it burn in catastrophic conditions?
Will, do you get the sense that big businesses really want to tackle climate change, or are we talking here about a lot of lip service?
Certainly, if you were to measure businesses' sincerity by the amount of times the word climate change and sustainability were mentioned here this week, we'd be well on our way to resolving the problem. But it's a question I put to John Denton. He's the Secretary General of the International Chamber of Commerce. That's the global umbrella group for 100 national chambers around the world, representing 45 million businesses.
Business is now way ahead of government. And business is not here to talk. Business is here to actually show what action it's doing. Yeah, of course, there'll be some laggards in the business community. But as a totality, the private sector is deeply engaged in the challenges of climate change. For example, we launched a coalition of action on climate change, bringing together chambers of commerce globally. We've got more than 2,000, that's 8 to 10 million businesses. They've signed up to 1.5 and net zero. I mean, that's a pretty serious commitment. And what we're doing now is helping build tools to support them in that transition. So this is actually engaging on science-based targets. This is engaging because we actually genuinely believe there needs to be change.
John Denton there from the International Chamber of Commerce. Well, you've also been talking to some of the Irish people attending Davos. Hello, Will.
Yes, another issue being considered here this week is how to make the workplace more inclusive for all, including those with... Hello, Rachel, can you hear me? Hello, Rachel.
Another issue being considered here this week is how
to make the workplace more inclusive for all, including those with disabilities. Okay. Caroline Casey, who is a former management consultant turned activist on disability issues, launched an organisation called The Valuable 500 at Davos last year. It aims to get 500 of the world's most influential companies to commit to putting disability on their leadership agenda and becoming a tipping point for change. This year she came back to Davos to announce how they've got on since.
I actually am emotional. It's a big thing 12 months later. I mean, when we launched this, it was this absolute belief that we could, but I didn't know if it was possible. But we have signed 240 companies, and that's with the signature of the CEOs around the world, and from Japan into America and Mexico and Ireland, with 13 companies from Ireland, and that represents 3.6 trillion in revenue, just under 10 million employees, 24 countries and 42 sectors. And that is a tipping point for change. And each of those CEOs have signed a commitment to action at leadership level. And so it can range from Unilever saying we want 5% of our employee base by 2025 to have a disability, to Salesforce, who have appointed a chief accessibility officer globally. And it doesn't matter if a company is beginning or scaling or leading. This is about leaders. Are you going to lead or are you going to follow?
And that was Caroline Casey. I gather for some reason we've developed a huge delay on the line. So I'm going to ask Will another question, and we may get a bit of a delay after that, but he is there. Was there anybody else there from Ireland over the past few days, Will?
Yes, I also met Professor Emma Teeling from UCD. She was invited to attend Davos by the European Research Council, which had funded some of her research. It's been looking at long-living bats and what they might be able to teach us about slowing down the ageing process and extend human health span.
The cost of having a short health span is huge to global economy. So it's estimated that a two-year increase in time of when the disease of aging will hit, will actually save the United States of America $7 trillion over 50 years. So if you can slow down when you get a disease of the old age, cancer, Alzheimer's, dementia, you're going to find ways to be able to not spend money on the incapacitated elderly. Now, that's an amazing saving in itself. And think about what you can do with $7 trillion. Think how many trees we could actually plant with $7 trillion. So aging costs the world money.
Professor Emma Teeling from UCD speaking to our business editor Will Goodbody in Davos.
France says it's intent on pursuing its own plans for a digital tax if there's no agreement on proposals being drawn up by the OECD. Speaking in Davos, the French finance minister said US proposals to make international tax rules optional were not workable. The head of the IDA told RTE News in Davos that it was hard to see how a digital tax made sense, given that it was difficult to distinguish a digital economy from the rest of the economy. Martin Shanahan was also talking about trade. He described Britain's timeline for the conclusion of trade talks with the EU by year end as ambitious. His comments came as the British Parliament passed the final stages of the Brexit withdrawal bill that paves the way for Britain to leave the EU in 8 days' time. Tesla's market value has topped $100 billion, making it the world's second most valuable car maker. It sees the electric car brand knock Volkswagen off the number two spot, putting it second only to Toyota in terms of market value. If it stays above $100 billion for more than 6 months, CEO Elon Musk would be entitled to a payout worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Currencies, the euro is trading at just below $1.11 and 84.4 pence sterling.
For the first time, every constituency will have at least one female candidate. When the official deadline for nominations passed yesterday, it emerged that just over 30% of candidates were women. However, the lobby group Women for Election has expressed disappointment that there hasn't been more change. Its chief executive, Kirine de Bush, is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
What had you been hoping for?
Well, we had asked all of the parties to be a lot more ambitious and to aim for 40% for women. It's great that there is a woman running in every constituency, and it is quite shocking that it is the first time there's a woman running in every constituency. But we should be aiming much, much higher than that. Women, we're not a minority group. We're the majority of the population, and the political parties need to be waken up to the fact that we should have diversity in politics, we should have more women in politics, and the onus is on them to do that. We have the gender quota legislation in place that ensures that parties either lose their money or put forward at least 30% women. But they seem to be seeing that as a target rather than a base. We should have at least 30% women, not just be scraping over 30%. We should be aiming for 40%.
Is it fair to say that some parties in this regard perform more strongly than others?
Absolutely. If you look at the Social Democrats, they would have done much, much better with more than half of their candidates are women. The Green Party, more than 40% of their candidates are women. People Before Profit also have quite a strong slate there of women, almost 40% of their candidates. Whereas if you look at the other end, Fine Gael just scraped over the quota with just 30% women, and Fianna Fáil, Labour and Sinn Féin weren't doing much better with 31, 32, 33% respectively. So they all need to be copping on to the fact that we're not a minority group. We are here. There isn't, I would defy any party to name any community across the country where there aren't women active in their local community. And why aren't they asking them to run as candidates?
Hasn't that always been the problem, though? Trying to translate, if you look around the country, there are a huge number of women who are involved in community groups, involved in lobbying, involved in all sorts of community activity, yet feel that mainstream politics isn't for them. Why is that?
Well, I'm not sure that they do feel that mainstream politics isn't for them. Women for Election train and support women to help them, equip them with the skills to ensure that they're election ready, we'll say. And one of the aspects to our training programme is that we would always have politicians come in and contribute to our training. And all of them invariably will say that they were asked to run, and they were usually asked more than once to run. Women, unfortunately, wait to be asked in politics, and politics is probably one of those games where you can't wait to be asked. But the parties are aware of this. So they need to be out there asking candidates to run and asking the women who are active in their local communities to run.
At the same time, though, should more women be putting themselves forward?
They should. And we would encourage all women who are interested politically to put their names forward. And I think what is very interesting are those smaller parties, or currently smaller parties like the Social Democrats and the Green Party. They have no problem in finding women. So there are women there, and they have no problem finding women across the country. So there are women there who are politically engaged, who have the skills, who do want to see their face on that poster. So the other parties need to be out there as well.
Why does this matter?
This matters because more women, more diversity leads to better decisions and better politics. All the research shows that a political system that reflects our population leads to better politics. We've seen that in practical terms, in terms of differences that have happened to legislation, for example, domestic violence legislation, the issue of coercive control came into the legislation because women came together in the Shannon and worked for that. There are real practical differences that women will make in politics. There's also the reality that if there are young kids at home looking at, for example, the party leaders debate and they see three men on the stage, it's much harder for them to envisage themselves, young girls, to envisage themselves in a career in politics. And that needs to change. And the onus is very much now on the parties to do that and to ask women to run. And they haven't been doing that enough.
Kieran de Bush of Women for Election, thank you for joining us.
Welcome back to our Cork studio in the centre of the southern capital. We're here this morning to catch up with the first in our series of leaders' interviews. The Labour Party had 7 TDs in the outgoing Dáil, a loss of 30 seats from the previous Dáil. There are standing 31 candidates in this election, and their leader, Brendan Howlan, is here with us in studio. Brendan Howlan, thank you very much for coming into us this morning.
Morning, Gavin. Nice
pensions,
to be in Cork.
You were a senior minister in the government that raised the pension age to 66 with the plan to raise it again to 67 next year and 68 later. Have you changed your mind?
Yes, I have. In truth, that was what we inherited from the Troika deal, and we had no money except what the Troika were providing, and that was put into place on that basis. But it hasn't happened yet. And a lot of the things that, you know, were forced upon the country at that stage should be rethought now. And certainly, fundamentally for us, and I thought this out some time ago, I made it clear at the Labour Party National Conference last November that this is what we would do, that 66 is a reasonable age. People want to work beyond that, and I changed the law to allow public servants to work till they're 70. I think everybody should be allowed, if they choose, to work to 70. But if they want to retire at 66 and get a full state pension, they should be entitled to do that. And that's our pledge, Labour's pledge, that we will hold it at that level.
But you argued in government that it was the right thing to do, to raise the pension age. But in opposition and in the heat of an election campaign, you've backtracked. Is that politically responsible?
As I explained to you, it's not in the heat of an election campaign that I came to that view, or the Labour Party came to that view. I set this out very clearly last November. And we've been thinking about it for a long time, because I've been dealing with individual cases of people who have worked all their lives, who then were told basically that they were unemployed for a period until they became eligible for a new state pension. That was wrong. I don't think the Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael approach to it, simply give people some sort of an additional token payment. You're either entitled to retire with the dignity of a state pension or you're not. And I think fixing it at 66 is a reasonable position. I know it was my predecessor, actually, Brendan Corish, who brought it down from 70 in the 70s, when it was originally 70. And I think that's a reasonable position to have 66 as the retirement age, to fund a full pension at that level, and that's Labour's commitment.
You pushed out the retirement age to 68 long term to make sure that pensions could be paid into the future. If you abandon those reforms, how much will it cost, and how will you pay for pensions when you consider that we're going to have less than two workers for every pensioner in some years' time?
Well, we didn't push it out because it hasn't happened yet. The cost of not increasing the pension age next year to 67 is about €220 million. And we've costed that in our budget profiles.
So that will go up every year.
It's that amount, because it'll be one cohort every year that will be coming of age. For example,
and that's along with the €1 billion over every 4 years to meet people getting older.
Yes, yes, that's the demographic. The economy is growing. You know, we've always overcome our indebtedness by a growing economy. The most conservative profiles say we'll have an envelope of about €11 billion over the next 5 years. So this is absolutely affordable in that context.
That's if things keep going well. There may be a downturn at some stage. Can you really afford this?
You have to plan on the basis of conservative estimates. This is a growth figure of about 2.5%. I think it'll be more. Certainly it'll be more this year. Everybody agrees on that. Brexit is an external challenge that we have faced up to. But I think, you know, if you ask anybody, my reputation and the Labour Party's reputation in government for being fiscally responsible is not questionable, because we've taken it in the neck for being careful with the public money, because we wanted a recovered economy. But the recovered economy has to be for a purpose, and the social dividend for that is decent public services. And our simple mantra in this election is to stop the waste of public money, which is happening under the Fine Gael stewardship, to fix health and to build homes for people. Those three issues will be front and centre for the Labour Party.
When you retire, it could be after this election, you'll get a pension of 88,000 a year and a lump sum of 140,000, isn't that right?
It's something of that. I haven't actually ever looked at the figures, because I have no intention of retiring. Of course, unless the good people of Wexford decide it's time, but I'm going to be asking them to keep me in a position to work for them and to work for the country.
You want to build 80,000 affordable homes over 5 years at a cost of €16 billion.
Yes. How? Where will we get the 16 billion? This will be completely new, and it's additional to the private house building programme that everybody else, every other party is aggregating into it. We're going to solve the housing crisis by building 80,000 social and affordable homes. It'll cost €16 billion. I've set out more than a year ago in our housing strategy where we'd get it. €5 billion from the Strategic Investment Fund. €4 billion from the dividend of NAMA. I think it would be the right thing to do with the profits made by NAMA to invest it in social and affordable housing again. I've had discussions both with the European Investment Bank and with the credit union movement, who have €14 billion that they want to invest productively. So there's much more than €16 billion available. This will obviously be a fund that will accrue money, because everybody who gets a social or affordable house will be paying a rent or a mortgage, and that will be re-energising the fund. So it'll be a permanent development fund for housing and will solve the housing crisis. That's Labour's objective.
Will you freeze rents if you're in government?
Yes, we will.
Why?
Because
it didn't work the last time you did it.
It did work. Alan Kelly froze rents in 2014.
And the average price of renting a house over those 2 years went up by 20%.
It went up for new tenants, but for anybody who is in accommodation, it couldn't go up because it was frozen.
But the average cost, according to the Residential Tenancies Board, but over those 2 years.
Well, it couldn't go up because they weren't allowed to go up for those for anybody who's actually an existing tenant. And the biggest cause of homelessness right now is increasing rents that are pushing people out. So what the Labour Party is saying very clearly, we will freeze the rents until our strategy of building sufficient, affordable and social houses comes on stream. I think that's reasonable. I think the actual amount of money going to landlords for rent is more than reasonable. The state is subsidising landlords each year now to the tune of 700 million euros. That's money we want to invest in the building of real homes and real communities for people who now are priced out of the housing market.
Do you want to go back into a government led by Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael?
I have, you know, I look at both parties and I listened to the debate last night with equanimity because I don't think there's a sliver of difference between the policy platform of either.
Okay.
So I'm only interested, I've set out five strategic goals, one on housing that we've talked about, one on health, which is investing in
sloughing. Do you want to go into a government led by either of those parties?
Only if our five strategic goals, health, housing, climate, childcare and work, giving workers the right to be represented by a trade union, those fundamental issues, if they're addressed, we will talk. I'm not interested in office. I'm not interested in anything else. Can we change fundamentally in a socially just way the nature of Irish society? Labour can and Labour will.
Just before I let you go, many of the people you're depending upon to win seats have been TDs for many years. Many are past the retirement age that you argued for earlier, but they failed to encourage running mates or develop successors. Why?
Well, that's not true. We've 31 candidates. The vast bulk of them are new candidates.
Many of them are in their 70s.
How many? Not more than a handful. Not more than a handful. And I'm not ageist about it. I think that all age groups should be represented in Parliament. We have very young candidates. Kira Kennedy in this city, John Maher in this city, two very young, new, vital candidates. If we had Kira Kennedy and John Maher, and you heard John talk on this programme earlier, I think they'd be hugely helpful, hugely transformative, alongside people of experience.
Okay, Brendan Howland, leader of the Labour Party, thank you very much for coming into our studio this morning.
Ireland has among the most progressive taxation regimes in Europe and does more than any other system in the EU to redistribute income and reduce inequality. That's one of the findings of a study being published today by the Economic and Social Research Institute. The author of the report is ESRI economist Dr. Barry Rowntree, who's here now. And this is the result of an analysis of earnings paid and taxes over a 30-year period, Barry. Before taxes, we've one of the most unequal distributions of income, but it's only when the taxation regime kicks in that that inequality reduces. So can we conclude we're a pretty heavily taxed population as workers?
Well, yeah. So what the study shows is that household income before taxes, benefits and pensions is the most unequally distributed in the EU. Once you add in pensions and benefits, we fall back to fifth. But it's only really when the tax system kicks in, when we look at take-home income after taxes, benefits and pensions, that we fall back to around mid-table, the EU average. And so if you compare across countries using the latest available data, it looks like the tax system in Ireland reduces the most commonly used measure of inequality by about a fifth, almost twice the EU average. So by those comparisons, certain groups in Ireland do pay quite a lot of tax and but in the same time, the tax system does that because we have such a high level of inequality before that. So there's some people who are paying a lot of tax, and in particular, that's due to some certain features of our tax system.
And the feature that brings it back into line with the EU average is there are a few levers there. I'm thinking the USC in particular, it's fairly blunt, but it's fair in the way that it's implemented.
Yeah, so what the USC, the Universal Social Charge, does is it applies to a very broad base of income. So it applies to not only employment and self-employment income, but also income from other unearned sources. And it also applies to those above the state pension age, which isn't the case for example, pay-related social insurance, PRSI. And income tax, there's also quite high exemption limits for those who are above the pension age. So really what the USC does is by applying this progressive tax, a tax that rises with your level of income, from a very to a very broad base of income, it does a lot to reduce inequality. And the other main feature then is the higher rate of income tax. So that kicks in comparatively early in Ireland at around 35,000 euro for a single adult, you start paying income tax at the higher rate of 40%. And that really does as well a lot of work to reduce income inequality. It means that those on higher levels of earnings are paying a higher share of their income in income tax.
Is it unusual that we only have two income tax levels here in Ireland, and the fact that we don't have a wealth tax? Is that something that we might see in other European countries?
So in terms of the number of bands, it's not particularly unusual. Many other countries have just the two bands, and you don't require lots of bands to have a progressive tax system. And indeed, that's precisely what, by the higher rate kicking in quite early, we kind of do away with the need to have additional bands. In terms of wealth tax, we have some forms of wealth tax. There's a local property tax every year, and property is the main form of household wealth. So we do actually tax not on the latest values, but we do tax the main form of household wealth. But there are other countries who have more substantive, more extensive forms of wealth taxes.
Is it possible to make the taxation regime more progressive, or does it come to a point where it becomes counterproductive when you introduce new measures?
So that's something we don't have great evidence for in Ireland, but it certainly would be politically difficult, it seems, to make the tax system more progressive. What it would require doing is to actually bring more people into the income tax net by cutting the tax credits, the personal and PAYE tax credits, or by moving forward to the point at which the higher rate kicks in even earlier. So doing those would actually reduce inequality further through the tax system, but they don't seem to be options that are particularly on the table at the moment.
Barbara Rowntree of the ESRI, thank you very much.
The record number of women running in the forthcoming election generates the lead story in the Irish Examiner, which reports that for the first time ever, with 531 female candidates, there will be a woman running in every constituency in the country. The focus of the lead story in the Irish Independent again today is on politicians' pensions. Senior TDs can start claiming gold-plated pensions in their 50s, is the headline there. Leo Varadkar's pledge to protect farmers' incomes by topping up any shortfall in the CAP budget with national funding provides the lead story in the Irish Farmers' Journal. And for its lead story, the Irish Times runs with the line that parties scrambled to promise changes to pension rules last night as fears grow of an auction election. That fear is also reflected in an editorial in today's paper under the headline "No Place for Auction Politics." And it's a sentiment which is also echoed in the lead editorial in The Independent, which runs under the headline "Our politicians must stop promising voters the earth." The Independent and Examiner both carry front page pictures this morning of Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin shaking hands before last night's Virgin Media debate. The picture on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, is a close-up of Mr. Varadkar answering a question during that debate about whether he had ever used drugs, which he answered by referencing an interview he did with Hot Press in which he previously admitted that he had smoked cannabis in college. Elsewhere on the front pages, the Irish Daily Star leads with details of the trial of Ciarán Greene for the murder of his partner's mother, Patricia O'Connor, in Dublin in May 2017. Evidence heard at yesterday's inquest into the shooting dead of Mark Hennessy by a Gartha at Cherrywood in Dublin in May 2018 generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror. And the Herald leads today with the line that up to 40 people have gone into hiding as a result of the Drogheda feud. The neighbours of the young man who was doused with petrol and set alight in Mayfield in Cork this week are organising a fundraiser for the victim and his family. That's according to the lead story in today's Echo. For its front page picture this morning, The Times runs with a shot of Ireland's rugby head coach Andy Farrell with his son and England captain Owen Farrell, taken at yesterday's launch of the Six Nations Championship. An interview which former Ireland captain Rory Best did on News Talk yesterday, in which he said that he regrets attending the Belfast rape trial, receives extensive coverage in all of today's papers. Back in the front of the Times, Jack Power reports on a letter sent by Dublin City Council to the Department of Housing last November, promising to drop claims that it was owed €12 million following the wind-up of the Dublin Docklands Authority in return for grant assistance for its proposed whitewater rafting facility. Elsewhere this morning, a number of today's papers report on the order made by Judge Gerald Keyes in Ennis Circuit Court yesterday to the owner of Vaughan's Pub in Kilfenora, County Clare, which featured in Father Ted, to pay €2,000 to Sky UK for showing unauthorised matches in the pub. The Examiner flags an interview on its front page today with the Murphy quadruplets from Cork, who marked their 18th birthday yesterday with a visit to Cork University Maternity Hospital, where they met with some of the 45 staff members who ensured their safe delivery 13 weeks ahead of their due date. Back in the Times, it's reported there that the operator of the new National Children's Hospital is looking at an NHS-style arrangement of acquiring blocks of apartments for staff. And the Times also has a piece today about a 90-year-old survivor of Auschwitz who has just decided to go public with her diary on the upcoming 75th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And finally, the Mail reports today that a new brand for Limerick is to be unveiled this week. We're told that Limerick City and County Council is spending €400,000 and has employed advertising agency M&C Saatchi on the branding project.
We're going to return now to the election campaign and to last night's televised debate between the leaders of the two largest parties. During the debate on Virgin Media One, Fine Gael's Leo Varadkar and Fianna Fáil's Micheál Martin were asked by Pat Kenny about health, pensions, government formation and Brexit. Another key issue was the provision of more housing.
It was normal enough in the past for people in their 20s or early 30s to be able to buy a house. Now that's unusual. Most people buying their first home are now well into their 30s. And I want to change that. We've already made a big change by introducing the Help to Buy scheme. That's helped 15,000 individuals and couples to buy their first home. I now want to expand that.
The fundamental point here, Pat, is people can't save for houses because of the excessive high cost of rent. I mean, there's a fundamental problem here for many, many people who want to buy their first house, and particularly young people. It's not affordable for them. And that's something we've been pushing.
During the debate, Leo Varadkar suggested that both party leaders needed to act like grown-ups, which drew this response from Micheál Martin.
We've been very grown up in the last 5 years, Leo. You haven't been so grown up. I mean, you've just talked about Fianna Fáil facilitating a conference supply agreement, and yet you go around the place for the last week or two calling us reckless. And there's been more personal attacks from Fine Gael on me than there has been on policies around education, childcare and other areas. That's the type of campaign you've run.
Leo Varadkar also addressed claims that he lacks empathy.
I care deeply about our country. I care deeply about the problems that people face. I probably can't put it into words as well as my opponent does, but I do it in my actions. We now have the second highest minimum wage in Europe. We reversed all the cuts to welfare, to disability, to carers that were made by previous governments. I brought in things like paternity benefit and parental leave so parents could spend more time with their kids. And I show my empathy. I show the fact I care in the work I do. Maybe I don't say the right words, but I show them the work I do.
Well, for their analysis of the debate, we're joined by RTE's political correspondent Micheál Lehane and by political commentator Lise Hand, who's been writing about the debate for journal.ie. Lise, for those who didn't see it last night, who took to the bed, how would you characterise this debate?
Well, I think it was probably sort of the opening match in a two-leg tie. I think it was quite cagey. I think both men were probably slightly defensive. They were trying to get the measure of the other side, because this really is the first time in this forum that they've gone head-to-head. Obviously, they've faced each other across the Dáil Chamber, but, you know, in a sort of a high-stakes game like this, this was the first time they faced each other. So I think, you know, it wouldn't possibly have won over many new voters to their cause, but they probably have what they hold. You know, Micheál Martin probably did as well as was expected of him, and Leo probably did slightly better than was anticipated of him.
Can we talk, Micheál, about Leo Varadkar's approach to the debate last night? Because he repeated something he started on the day he called the election, and that was that again and again he kept acknowledging the government's failures and saying he wished they'd done more on housing and on health in particular.
Yeah, this is the new message, and this was a degree of humility that we haven't seen before from Leo Varadkar. And I suppose wrapping humility in a political sales pitch is a fairly complex product, and if it goes wrong, it can be torn apart fairly easily. I think last night, in some ways, it probably just about worked, and it definitely set the tone for the debate in the early part, and it allowed Leo Varadkar to set out his stall in that regard. I suppose in many ways he has no choice but to say this and to talk about the government's shortcomings in the area of housing and health, because all the statistics, the waiting list, the housing list, they're all there for all to see. But he is demonstrating humility, also expressing regret and sorrow, and saying Fine Gael, more had been expected of them and they had let people down at times. For those reasons and the way that he played that particular pitch, I think he probably maybe just shaded it. Micheál Martin's approach to the debate was a traditional one, in the sense it was the way that he would debate in the Dáil, effective in many ways. But this was a different style of Leo Varadkar he was dealing with last night.
They did, Lise, spend a considerable amount of time discussing Sinn Féin, who weren't there.
Well, yes. I mean, Mary Lou and Sinn Féin had made, you know, quite a great deal over the fact that they weren't in the debate, and they were both. But the both party leaders spent some time discussing that. They, again, both men ruled out any coalition with the with a possible coalition afterwards with Sinn Féin. Leo Varadkar said that they weren't a normal party, and Micheál Martin once again kind of linked how they sort of, you know, deal with issues from the past and so on. But it was also notable, I think, that both men were kind of, you know, fluttering their eyelashes in the direction of former coalition partners. They were both quite nice to Brendan Howlan. Micheál Martin pointed out that he had been the one that actually had drawn attention to the pension gap issue. And
even though Labour were part of the government Absolutely. That introduced the pensions gap, so I suppose you could say, well, why wouldn't he know about it?
Exactly. Well, this is very true. But I think, you know, they were both wanted to try and leave as many doors open for possible, you know, talks afterwards, even, as it turns out, in the case of the Taoiseach with Fianna Fáil.
Can we turn to that, Micheál? What did Leo Varadkar say about the possibility of a coalition with Fianna Fáil? He did kind of throw it out there.
He did, and he said it in the clearest terms possible. I suppose not entirely unprecedented, in the sense that this is something that Enda Kenny had offered Micheál Martin before. But he said his preference, obviously, is to form a government with old allies. But if there were no other option, and if things had to go that way, then he is open to the possibility of a coalition with Fianna Fáil. Micheál Martin didn't bite on that one at all, just kept emphasising that after 9 years, the time had come for a new government. But it was an interesting approach. It was interesting, I suppose, in its timing and in the fact that it was entirely unambiguous.
Can we talk about the toe-curling moment, Lise, the drugs moment? What happened?
Well, you know, us in the media were sort of outside in a room watching this, and, you know, when the question was put by Pat Kenny to both men, you know, had they ever taken illegal drugs, and Micheál Martin immediately replied, no, he hadn't. And when the same question was put to Leo, he was quite clearly flummoxed, and, you know, there were kind of groans from you know, all the media sitting outside as the silence, you know, went on.
And on.
Oh, I mean, you know, glaciers sort of, you know, rose and fell and receded again, you know, by the time he actually got around to, he was actually prompted, you know, to kind of continue the answer. And he went to reply that he had given an interview to Hot Press, you know, many years ago, and he dealt with the issue. And then it was actually Micheál Martin who interjected and said, you know, did you or didn't you? You know, so I was actually very surprised at this, because he had actually gotten this question last week. I was at a doorstep with him up in Drogheda when he was up there in the wake of the terrible events there. And the question was put to him. So I'm fairly surprised he wasn't actually ready for it. Now, does it do him any harm? I'm not so sure. I mean, in a way, it even humanised him further, because, you know, it wasn't the sort of the four wheels came off the slick, political wagon. So, you know, I suppose it remains to sort of to see how it plays out over the next few days.
The pensions issue, Micheál, was raised. Did we learn anything new?
No, I think you still see that both Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil are really trying to get their message finally honed on this. And it has taken some days. We know that Fine Gael is talking about a transition payment, Fianna Fáil a review and pausing the increase to 67 and paying a transition payment up to that point. In the meantime, this is something that they have got repeatedly throughout the campaign trail over the last 2 days. That's the message coming back from across the countries, from across the country. Have they arrived at a message that will be sufficient now to get through the rest of the campaign? Well, I think looking at that last night, you couldn't be absolutely sure on that. I think it is going to continue to linger.
Are you looking forward to the next debate, Lise?
Well, I mean, I sincerely hope that, you know, it is a proper second tie where there's, you know, there's plenty of, plenty of action. So, yeah, I am, of course. I'm a political nerd. Why would I not?
Lise Hand and Micheál Lehane, thank you both very much.
The Chinese government is halting flights and trains from today out of Wuhan, the city of 11 million people at the centre of the deadly SARS-like coronavirus outbreak, as the UN extended emergency talks on the disease. There are more than 500 confirmed cases now, and 17 people have died. All the fatalities so far have been in Hubei, the province around Wuhan, but cases have been detected in Thailand, Japan and the US. WHO chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said he was postponing a decision on whether or not to declare a global health emergency, saying he needed more information. But he praised China's measures to contain the outbreak.
What they're doing is a very, very strong measure and with full commitment. So based on the situation, taking the action that they think is appropriate is very important. We stress to them that by having a strong action, not only they will control the outbreak in their country, but they will also minimize the chances of this outbreak spreading internationally.
For more on this, we're joined from Wuhan by Kildare man Ben Kavanagh. He lives in the Chinese province that's affected. Ben, good morning. Thanks for taking our call.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me where you are and how you're affected by the virus.
Well, right now I'm just sitting in my apartment and there's no chance of me going outside anytime soon because everyone's saying not to leave at any point at all.
And are there people out on the streets?
Usually the street I can see from my apartment would be quite busy, but I live near a dual carriageway that I can see, and that it's almost like a ghost town.
Are people allowed out or are they staying in because they're worried?
You are allowed out, but there's been so many rumours and things that are happening that it's just better not to. Recently, we've been told that it can transmit through eyes now. So people have been wearing masks to keep the infection at bay, but now we're being told to wear eye protection as well, because that's another way we can be infected. I believe that's how the people in the hospital have been transmitting it.
When was the last time you went out?
Maybe 2-3 days ago. And I don't know, it blurs into one after a while.
Do you need to go out again soon?
I have enough water. I have plenty of water, but I am running a bit low on food. So tomorrow morning I will head out early and get to the shops. But that's the other thing. The shops, a lot of places are being closed and a lot of places have really increased their prices of food. I'm seeing celery that's tripled in price just because people are panicking and buying what they can.
Now, it's Chinese New Year this week. You're on holidays from school, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. I finished on Friday, which is, it's just come at the worst possible time, because that's why people are travelling so much, because it's holiday time and they're going to see their families.
Are you worried?
The only thing that's changed for me for the worry, nothing's really changed for the virus, but everyone's just taking it a lot more seriously. So I wasn't worried 4 or 5 days ago when it was the same situation. But now that everyone's taking it more seriously, it does play on your mind a bit.
If you have to go out tomorrow to get some food, what precautions are you going to take?
Well, I'll have a surgical mask and I'll actually probably wear swimming goggles just to be safe.
Do you know, or is it known yet, is it like flu? Can it be caught from somebody who doesn't have symptoms?
Apparently, the first symptom you'll see if you have it would be a fever, because it is like the common cold. That's, people say it's like SARS, but it's just a coronavirus. So it could be as bad as SARS or just the common cold. They're both coronaviruses. So it can be bad. But so far, the only people to have died have all been 50 plus, and most of them have been, you know, elderly.
How long are you expecting all this to last, or do you have any idea?
Oh, I have no idea. Apparently, I was talking to people earlier today and they said when this happened with SARS, it was 3 months that things were closed down and things were happening. I think that was 2002, but I have no idea what to expect. I mean, I've never been in a situation like this before.
Would you prefer to be back in general election Ireland?
I don't know. The debates might be too much for me.
Rather than being surrounded by a killer virus?
It's 50-50, to be honest.
Ben Kavanagh, originally from Kildare, but now living in the Wuhan city, which is affected by that coronavirus in China. Thank you very much for taking our call this morning. It's 8:30. Let's go back to Dublin now and get the latest news headlines with Brian Jennings.
Discover the Hyundai electric and hybrid range for 2020 with a bigger choice of models designed for eco-motoring. Discover the Kona electric, the all-new Kona hybrid, the Tucson mild hybrid, or the all-new Ioniq electric, the latest innovation in our range of eco-models. Visit Hyundai.ie to discover our electric and hybrid range, alongside our more eco-friendly Euro 6, petrol and diesel models. Hyundai, the best of all worlds. Discover why.
Just 5 more minutes.
Phones, tablets, TVs, computers. With so many screens, it can be tough to get kids up and active. Make a start by making bedrooms screen-free zones, putting the screens away during mealtimes, playing active games together, and reducing screen time by 30 minutes a day. That goes for mum and dad too. Pause for play today and start your kids on the way to a healthier life. For more ideas on getting active, visit makeastart.ie. Brought to you by Safe Food, HSE and Healthy Ireland.
RTE Radio 1. Time to
Andrea Bocelli, live in concert. Three Arena, October 21st, sold out. Due to phenomenal demand, an extra date has been added on October 22nd. The world's most acclaimed tenor with orchestra and choir. Tickets for the extra date available now from Ticketmaster.
Music updates on RTE Radio 1.
And we will now get the news from Brian Jennings.
Thank you, Rachel. Campaigning in the general election continues today, with political parties focusing on education, climate action, online safety and mental health. The first televised debate between the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil leaders took place last night on Virgin Media One. Health, housing, crime and the issue of pensions were among the main topics. China has effectively sealed off the city of Wuhan as it tries to contain the coronavirus outbreak that originated there. Transport services, including flights, buses and trains, have been suspended. More than 570 people are confirmed to have been infected with the respiratory virus and 17 have died. Ben Kavanagh, who is originally from Kildare, lives in Wuhan. Speaking on this programme, he said people living in the region are panicking.
Recently, we've been told that it can transmit through eyes now. So people have been wearing masks to keep the infection at bay, but now we're being told to wear eye protection as well, because that's another way we can be infected. I believe that's how the people in the hospital have been transmitting it.
With the news in detail now, here's Brian Jennings.
Campaigning in the general election continues today, with political parties focusing on education, climate action, online safety and mental health. The first televised debate between the Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil leaders took place last night on Virgin Media One. Our political correspondent, Micheál Lehan.
This much anticipated debate did not see either leader land a decisive blow. Leo Varadkar cast himself as a humble politician who knows all about his government's failings. He expressed sorrow and regret over shortcomings in the provision of housing, but there was a caveat that things are changing now and plans are working. The Fianna Fáil leader repeatedly said the time had come for a new government and asked if Mr. Varadkar had any shame at all over what he said were many broken promises. And Micheál Martin did not reciprocate an offer from Leo Varadkar to form a coalition government after the election if there was no other option. The next televised debate is on RTE1 next Monday night, when 7 party leaders will discuss their election policies. In the meantime, the campaign continues today, with Fianna Fáil focusing on education. Sinn Féin will unveil its plans for mental health services, while Fine Gael will outline its policy around online safety. Labour will speak about climate action, and the Social Democrats will look at quality of life issues for families. People Before Profit will launch its disability charter and access for all on public transport.
Research by the Economic and Social Research Institute has found that the Irish tax system does more than any other system in the EU to redistribute income and reduce inequality. It also finds that raising the point at which taxpayers pay the higher rate of tax or abolishing the USC would both favour those on higher incomes. Our economics correspondent Robert Short.
Ireland has the most unequal share of income in the EU before social welfare benefits or income taxes are applied. In research released today, the ESRI finds the Irish tax system reduces this inequality by more than any other tax system in Europe. After tax and social welfare payments, Ireland ranks in the mid-range of inequality in the EU. It also finds that Ireland would become significantly more unequal if the standard rate band was increased to €50,000 or the universal social charge was abolished. The ESRI concludes that it's because the impact of the system is so bound up with income that it may no longer be able to deliver any further reduction in income inequality. Instead, it recommends that tax reliefs and payments like the Family Income Supplement should be examined.
China has effectively sealed off the city of Wuhan as it tries to contain the coronavirus outbreak that originated there. Transport services, including flights, buses and trains, have been suspended. More than 570 people are confirmed to have been infected with the respiratory virus, and 17 have died. The World Health Organization will resume a meeting today to consider whether to declare the outbreak an international public health emergency. Dr. Michael Ryan from the WHO said there were many unknowns about the virus.
The primary issue is to limit human-to-human transmission, to reduce secondary infections, especially amongst close contact and particularly in healthcare environments. We need to prevent transmission through amplification events and super-spreading events, and obviously prevent further international spread.
World leaders are gathering in Jerusalem to mark the 75th anniversary of the Soviet liberation of the Auschwitz death camp in Poland, where more than a million people, mostly Jews, were murdered by the Nazis. The Russian and French presidents are attending, as are US Vice President Mike Pence and Britain's Prince Charles. But the ceremony has been overshadowed by the decision of Poland's President Andrzej Duda not to travel, because he was not invited to speak at the event. Poland, which has been in dispute with both Russia and Israel over the interpretation of historical events, will hold its own commemoration next week. In a BBC interview, Poland's Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki said offence had been caused by what he described as a rewriting of history by the Russians.
President Putin and some of his allies, if I may say so, from Israel, they organized another commemoration, and this was also preceded by many statements made by the highest Russian officials, which distorted perception of the Second World War and distorted the facts.
Australian officials say three people were killed when a large air tanker plane involved in fighting bushfires crashed in a mountainous area south of the capital, Canberra. The New South Wales Rural Fire Service said authorities lost contact with the aircraft while it was operating in the snowy Monaro region. Reports say the three crew members were American firefighters, with the United States, one of several countries that have sent special teams to help battle the numerous wildfires. The New South Wales Premier Gladys Berejiklian paid tribute to those involved in the effort.
It demonstrates the dangerous work currently being undertaken, and it also demonstrates the conditions that our firefighters are working under. There are in excess of 70 aircraft that have been used today alone, and today is a stark and horrible reminder of the dangerous conditions that our volunteers, our emergency services personnel across a number of agencies undertake on a daily basis.
Now the time is coming up to 8:30 past eight.
RTE Radio 1 weather with ESB Networks. Stay safe, stay clear when working near overhead electricity wires. For emergencies, call 1850 372 999.
Fog in many areas at first, dense in places, clearing slowly during the morning. Dry in most areas today, but mostly cloudy with a little patchy light rain or drizzle in places. Highest temperatures 7 to 10 degrees.
Well, we'll see little change in our weather over the next few days, staying mostly dry up to and including Saturday, but there will be some patchy drizzle and fog as well. In fact, it's very foggy across the country this morning with many dense pockets, so some fairly dangerous driving conditions. Now, the fog will clear slowly during the morning, though it could linger on in some southern parts through the early afternoon. A dry day in most areas, but mostly cloudy, with a little bit of patchy light rain or drizzle in places. Temperatures close to normal today with highs of 7 to 10 degrees and the winds mostly light and variable, but moderate southwesterly winds will develop along northwest coasts. Tonight will stay dry in most areas, but again there'll be some mist and fog becoming widespread, particularly in Munster and Leinster, with dense pockets in places. Patchy light rain and drizzle also becoming persistent in northern and northwestern coastal areas. Minimum temperatures 3 to 6 degrees. And for tomorrow, Friday, very little change. The fog will clear gradually during the morning and it'll be another mostly dry day. But again, there'll be some patchy light rain and drizzle, which will be persistent in parts of the north and northwest early on. Highest temperatures 7 to 10 degrees. Similar temperatures on Saturday and again another mostly dry day with further patches of light rain and drizzle though, especially on Atlantic coasts. Overnight on Saturday, a band of more persistent rain will move gradually across the country from the west, clearing later to scattered showers. And then for the early days of next week, it's going to turn a lot colder, with a mix of brighter sunny spells on Sunday and scattered showers. Most of the showers in Connacht, West Ulster and Munster, and they'll turn wintry later, that's to sleet, with a risk of snow over high ground. For Monday and Tuesday, staying very cold with brighter sunny spells, scattered showers as well, many of them wintry, and there's a risk of thunder and highest temperatures of just 3 to 7 degrees in moderate to fresh southwesterly winds. Early indications are that it'll become milder after midweek, but unsettled again. Finally, quick recap on today's weather. A mostly dry day, but misty, with fog slowly clearing. That's all from us at Met Éireann. Good morning.
Children's Ombudsman has said that both the HSE and the Child and Family Agency, TUSLA, are still failing to meet their obligations to children with disabilities in state care. Niall Muldoon's report follows on from the case of Molly, a little girl with a severe disability who has been in foster care since birth. Both bodies say that while they have made progress, a lot of work remains to be done. Niall Muldoon is with us. Good morning.
Good morning.
Will you remind us, first of all, of Molly's story and of why your office became involved?
Molly was a young girl who was born with severe disabilities and she needs help with toileting, dressing, feeding. She's non-verbal. She's been in foster care since about 3 months old because she was abandoned at birth. And in the period of time up to about 13, 14 years of age, her foster mother was fighting with both agencies to try and get the support that was required for Molly at all times. And she eventually felt emotionally exhausted and came to us looking for assistance in that regard. We investigated it. We produced an investigation report in 2018, recommended that both HSE and TUSLA need to start working together with this, with Molly particularly. But also we found that there was a cohort of children, about 470 odd children, who were in care of the state, but also with moderate to severe disabilities, and they needed to be looked after in a different way, with a cooperative manner. We followed up on that investigation last year in 2019 and found that there was some progress, but still both agencies hadn't done enough, and we said we'd give them another 12 months, which is something unusual from our point of view. We felt that it was worthwhile to give them that opportunity to work better and improve it. TUSLA had identified to 488 children at that stage who were in that category, but the HSE were arguing that that wasn't the case. They didn't agree with the definitions of what a child was, moderate to severe disability. They'd worked very well with Molly, and we followed up this year now in 2020, and we find that the work with Molly has been extremely good. They've improved enormously. Her education has improved. Her support for her carers have improved. Her overall diet and all the areas of need have been looked after very, very well. There's still some small issues there, but from our point of view, they've cooperated very well in that particular one. But both agencies are clear that they haven't done enough work nationwide. And from my point of view, I think the HSE have really ignored their responsibility in this regard. By even the spirit of our recommendation was that you work with the children in those need who are in state care. So we are the parents. We need to do best by them because we've said that we can do a better job than their parents.
So what's the main problem then? What is it, in your view, that the HSE isn't doing?
They're not cooperating with TUSLA in a way that we feel is supportive of the children. There's a constant argument over who's funding what, who, what the foster carers come looking for special assistance and something. It's really there's a real demarcation as to who would fund what. HSE see the child as a child with a disability, but not a child in care. TUSLA see the child in care, but not the child with a disability. And these agencies need to mould better together.
Is that one of the problems here, that there are two agencies and that they're not always the best at communicating with each other?
Well, the two agencies is a misnomer, because this wasn't great when there was HSE was in charge of everything.
Okay.
So I think we're at an old system trying to make it better. But from our point of view, there is a system in place. We've shown that with Molly it can be done. We've shown that by providing her with all the extra support she needed, she was able to stay in foster care as opposed to going to residential. HSE need to take up this chance and see that children in this situation, it's not about defining their diagnosis. It's about protecting them and supporting them in the fullest possible manner. They have made steps forward. They're offering extra respite there, but they're not able to tell us how much respite is going into children. And they're very clear, and they're very proud of the fact that they work together. TUSLA and HSE have identified children who are coming up to 18 years of age who will move into the HSE. But I can't understand, from my point of view, why that system doesn't work for children earlier, and then mm-hmm. you budget accordingly for so that the parents don't have to fight for that money.
You said at the outset there that it was unusual for your office to give the agencies another year mm-hmm. to improve. What are you going to do now?
Well, from my point of view now, I'm going to bring this report. Unfortunately, there's obviously a lack in the government set up at the moment, but my target will be to bring this report to both the Oireachtas Committee on Health and the Oireachtas Committee on Children, and ask them to work together to bring both agencies to heel and to make sure that the work is done in the way that it should be done and as quickly as possible.
Niall Muldoon, Children's Ombudsman.
Voters' views from the constituencies. Over the next 3 weeks, we're visiting key ones to gauge the mood and sentiment of voters as polling day draws closer. Cian McCormack is in Thurles in County Tipperary today. Morning, Cian. You spent yesterday travelling the constituency talking to people. Where did you go and what are people talking about?
Well, Gavin, people are talking about health and housing. In every conversation I had yesterday, those were the issues mentioned over and over again. I'll be bringing you some of those views in a few moments. But my journey yesterday, it brought me from the north of the constituency to the south, from Bersicane to Clonmel. And geography really plays an important part in the way people will vote here in Tipperary. Ronan Dodd of the Tipperary Star explained this to me.
Tipperary covers a huge geographical area. I mean, it's 75 miles from Portumna Bridge down to the Waterford border, down to Carrick and Shore. It was originally two constituencies, but was amalgamated in 2016. However, it's still two constituencies, basically. People up north won't vote for people down south. People down south won't vote for people up north.
The issues, what are they?
Health is a big issue here. The constituency is served by South Tipperary General Hospital in Clonmel, and in the north by University Hospital in Limerick, both of which have suffered from horrendous overcrowding problems over the last number of years. Housing is another issue. The last records that I saw, there were over 200 people officially homeless in the county. Farming. This is a big farming county, a big farming constituency. Things like, while you know, Brexit will affect some industries, it will impact hugely on farming, especially dairy farming. And then you have the beef crisis, you have climate change, you have CAP reform. Farming is a big issue here. You know, down here, it's still rural roads. You know, it's still jobs, especially around Tiptown, around Ross Grey, places to feel they have been neglected.
Cian, you mentioned health and housing as main issues in Tipperary, but were there other issues?
Yeah, there were, Gavin, but health and housing really dominated all of the conversations that I was having yesterday. There were other issues, of course, like beef prices. It's quite an agricultural constituency, and jobs too. But here's a sample of what people were telling me as I travelled around the Premier County.
Well, being a farmer, well, I suppose beef prices have been an important issue for me. Us beef farmers aren't, we'd feel we're not getting a fair crack at the whip.
Okay, what are the big issues around cattle?
I suppose housing and health.
So how would you describe your mood at this point in time?
Good.
Yeah, why?
Good, good. Well, everything seems to be humming, like things are good in the country, I think. Well, things are going good. What they were back about 10 years ago, what were they? Like, we were down, and like, things are up, people have work and everything else.
What has the bigger influence on your vote then? Because initially when we started talking, immediately you said, oh, health housing. Yeah. And now you're saying, well, things are humming along,
yeah,
things are
yeah,
better.
But those things, I listen, that's all, like the media thing, like has been pushed, health and everything else, isn't it?
Well, I mean, what will influence your vote then?
Well, I have to listen to what's going on for the next 3 weeks. That will influence me a lot.
Locally, for Thurles, it's, I suppose, jobs, and there's not very much jobs here. A lot of people are travelling outside Thurles and away to get jobs, you know, so there's not a whole lot here of industry, which we would like to see more of. And then nationally, sure, it's homelessness and the health system. I mean, if you have an older parent or someone, you really don't want them facing into the hospital in A&E. At this, Limerick is our closest, and it's really not where you want to be going, is it?
What are the issues here in Clonmel?
I think healthcare and the running of the local hospital. And I know they build extra beds. We have 40 extra beds opened up locally here. But I think if the economy is doing well, then it's a terrible indictment on the guys with a good economy that we can't have better health service and housing for, you know, the people that are homeless.
When you compare where we are now to maybe 9 years ago...
Same old, same old. I don't see much difference, to be honest.
Has the economy not improved? Has employment not improved?
Yes, it has, but for some people, it's still very much Dublin-centric. Being from Dublin originally, I can see it. It's obvious that all the big business, all the big investment, all the Googles and the LinkedIns and everything of this world are all funneled in there, and there's no interest in trying to disperse the workforce. To be honest, at the moment, most politicians all just seem to be just, they mould into one. I can't see the difference between one and the other. So I'm waiting to see, you know, as the next couple of weeks progress, what happens, because at the moment I have no idea who I'd vote for.
Still making up their minds, the views of voters in Tipperary there. Well, joining me now is Noel Dundon of the Tipperary Star. Noel, many issues in the constituency. Health, housing, homelessness, I've mentioned them already. Jobs in places like Tipperary Town and here in Thurles. What are candidates focusing on?
Well, you can probably throw in rural crime into that as well, Cian. You know, housing and health obviously are the big ones, and particularly health, I suppose, because you have a situation where the two major hospitals serving the county here, South Tipperary General Hospital and University Hospital Limerick, are constantly overcrowded, and we're hearing horror stories every week of people spending hours and hours before they can even get to a trolley. So they're big, big issues, and I think candidates are meeting those on the doorstep, along with the rural crime issue. That has been a big, big issue here in Tipperary, and you can throw in the drugs issue with that too, you know. There will be a lot of concern about the level of and scale of drug taking here and availability of drugs.
Well, 5 seats up for grabs here in the Tipperary constituency. Lots of personalities, constituency boundary changes, but who'll be the winners or losers?
Yeah, like, you have 14 candidates here on the ballot paper at the moment. You have 5 sitting TDs, you have 3 county councillors, a former councillor, you have the brother or the sister of a current TD, you have the son of a former TD, and you have a couple of new candidates. So, like, it's a real mixed bag, and it's hard to see. I suppose really the big question is going to be whether or not Fine Gael can win back a seat. But I think, you know, before all the ballot papers are counted, there'll be a lot of blood on the floor here in Tipperary.
Well, Fine Gael, as you say, they'll be fighting hard to take a seat here. They failed to return a TD in 2016. Do you expect a political earthquake? You have independents here like Michael Lowry and Matty McGrath. You have Labour's Alan Kelly.
I don't know about an earthquake. I mean, really and truly, the major question is whether Fine Gael can take that seat. They had enough for a seat the last time. They had more than a quota when Noel Coonan and Tom Hayes, who was an outgoing minister at the time, both lost their seats. And, you know, they may be heading down the same route this time again, where you've got two candidates in Garrett Ahern, the son of former TD, the late Teresa Ahern, and then you have Mary Newman Julian, who's the sister of Kate O'Connell. They're going to be vying for that Fine Gael seat if they get a seat.
Would you dare calling it at this stage?
It's probably too early yet, but I mean, the big thing is, if they take a seat, who are they going to take it off of? Because you have a situation where Matthew McGrath and Michael Lowry and Jackie Cadd would probably seem to be safe. Alan Kelly came into the last election and was elected on the final count without reaching the quota, but he would seem to have consolidated his position big time in the last 4.5 years or so, and that leaves Seamus Healy, who's a real battler. So it's going to be a big task to take a seat off any of those 5.
Well, that's it from the five-seater of Tipperary, whereas Noel Dundon of the Tipperary Star expects there could be blood on the floor after this election campaign. But before I go, there are 14 candidates running here in the Tipperary constituency. They are Garrett Ahern, Fine Gael, Martin Brown, Sinn Féin, Dolores Cahill, the Irish Freedom Party, Jackie Cahill, Fianna Fáil, Sandra Farrell, Fianna Fáil, Imelda Goldsborough, Fianna Fáil, Joe Hannigan, Independent, Seamus Healy, Independent, Alan Kelly, Labour, Michael Lowry, Independent, Matty McGrath, Independent, Mary Newman, Julian, Fine Gael, Rob O'Donnell, the Green Party, and Mairéad Sheehan, Independent.
The Independent and Examiner both carry front page pictures this morning of Leo Varadkar and Micheál Martin shaking hands in advance of last night's television debate on Virgin Media. The picture on the front of the Irish Daily Mail, meanwhile, is a close-up of Mr. Varadkar answering a question during that debate about whether he had ever used drugs, referencing an interview he did with Hot Press in which he previously admitted that he had smoked cannabis in college. Mr. Varadkar answered with the line that it was a long time ago. The focus of the lead story in The Independent again today is on politicians' pensions. Senior TDs can start claiming gold-plated pensions in their 50s, is the headline there. The record number of women running in the election generates the lead story in The Examiner, which reports that with 531 female candidates running, for the first time ever, there will be a female candidate in every constituency in the country. A pledge made this week by Leo Varadkar to protect farmers' incomes by topping up any shortfall in the CAP budget with national funding provides the lead in the Irish Farmers' Journal. And for its lead story, meanwhile, the Irish Times runs with the line that parties scrambled to promise changes to pension rules last night as fears grow of an auction election. The paper also runs with an editorial on the pensions controversy under the headline, No Place for Auction Politics. And that sentiment is also echoed in the lead editorial in The Independent. Our politicians must stop promising voters the earth, is the headline there. Elsewhere on the front pages this morning, the Irish Daily Star leads with details of yesterday's court case in the Central Criminal Court, in which Kieran Green is pleading not guilty to the murder of his partner's mother, Patricia O'Connor, in Rathfarnham in Dublin in May 2017. Evidence given at yesterday's inquest into the death of Mark Hennessy by the Garda who shot him dead at Cherrywood in Dublin in May 2018 generates the lead story in the Irish Daily Mirror. And the Herald leads today with the line that up to 40 people, including women and children, have gone into hiding as a result of the Drogheda feud. We must stand up together. That's the lead headline in today's Echo, which reports that neighbours of the young man who was doused with petrol and set alight in his home in Mayfield in Cork this week are organising a fundraiser for the victim and his family. Fears that the deadly coronavirus may spread outside China, where 10,000 people are currently infected, are covered in the lead story in the Irish Sun. And for its front page picture this morning, the Times runs with a shot of Ireland head coach Andy Farrell with his son and England captain Owen Farrell at the launch of this year's Six Nations Championship in London. Ireland captain Johnny Sexton also features in that picture, while an interview with former Ireland captain Rory Best, which he did with the Off the Ball radio programme on News Talk, in which he said that he regrets attending the Belfast rape trial, is flagged on the front of The Examiner, and it also receives coverage in a number of today's other papers. And finally, back in the front of The Times, Jack Power reports on a letter sent by Dublin City Council to the Department of Housing last November, promising that the council would drop claims that it was owed €12 million following the wind-up of the Dublin Docklands Authority in return for grant assistance for its proposed whitewater rafting facility.